Religious Christians will object that I have painted a psychological picture of hell that leaves out Satan. To leave out Satan is to ignore biblical texts, which tells us of the angel Lucifer, closest to God among all the angels, who disobeyed him and fell through the sin of pride until he reached the farthest place in creation, hell. That millions of people literally believe in this myth says a great deal about our refusal to take responsibility for the afterlife. We prefer to objectify a prince of darkness, an all-powerful opposite of God, who then becomes the agent of all evil. Taking responsibility for hell seems awful, but not taking responsibility is the same as giving up on ourselves. Hell is farthest from God because it represents the low ebb of consciousness. When we become disconnected from ourselves, a sense of deserving to suffer begins. Hell is the suffering you think you deserve. When connections are repaired, we no longer believe we deserve punishment. We are back in the flow of life with all its healing properties. Everything Satan stands for is included in our own self-judgment. Indeed, he's a massive reflection of self-judgment. Our culture has largely moved beyond Satan because, despite religious literalists, we have a century of secularism behind us. Whatever its faults, which can be glaring, secular culture has promoted therapy, discouraged superstition, given people responsibility over their own destinies, and encouraged open-minded dialogue in every area once considered taboo. These are considerable achievements. They bespeak tremendous growth in consciousness. Evil, however you define it, remains even after Satan is gone. But removing our attention from Satan has diminished him greatly, just as the ancient gods of Mount Olympus, once so powerful that they served to explain every natural phenomenon, are now relegated to history. Good and evil, the rishis tell us, is a direct functioning of being connected to the soul. The soul is the most real aspect of the self. When we break our connection with the soul, we lose touch with reality. The soul is disguised when you are too tired or stressed. You are pulled outside yourself. Your attention is dominated by externals. You let others think for you. You act out of compulsion. You are influenced by fear and anxiety. You struggle and suffer. These conditions have to change before the soul connection can be re-established. Death provides access to the domain of the soul, but Vedanta declares that the soul has a great deal to offer before death. Life is conducted under the gaze of the soul. Your portion of pure consciousness has certain universal qualities. It is constant. It never loses sight of you. It is connected to every other soul. It shares God's omniscience. It is untouched by change. It lives beyond time and space. So it isn't only tender, loving, quiet moments that reveal the soul. Rather, it's those moments when the soul's own qualities come to the surface that are most important. Such moments occur too rarely in modern lives, but the soul never stops revealing itself. The soul is revealed when you feel centered. Your mind is clear. You have the sensation that time has stopped. You suddenly feel free of boundaries. You are keenly self-aware. You feel merged with another person, either in love or silent communion. You feel untouched by aging and change. You feel blissful or ecstatic. You have an intuitive flash that turns out to be true. You somehow know what is going to happen. You sense the truth. You feel supremely loved or absolutely safe. If there is only one reality, as the rishis declare, then life is not a struggle between good and evil, but a tangled web where all actions, good and bad, move us closer to reality or deeper into illusion. Karma is the binding effect that spins the web. Karma isn't a prison, it's a field of choice. Because it ties cause to effect, karma keeps our choices honest. We sow what we reap, but this is far from saying that we are trapped by the forces of cosmic good and evil.